This program is brought to you by Fine Diners Over 40, a members-only dinner club for singles and couples who enjoy dining at highly rated restaurants and sharing the experience with others. Learn more at finediners over40.com. That's finediners over40.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I'm your host, Andrew Friedman, here as always with my wife. And do we say co-host if you're just here for the intro?
I don't know. That's really funny, though. I don't feel like I'm the co-host.
My wife and intro co-host, okay. Caitlin Friedman.
Hi, Andrew.
We got to come up with a term for that.
Okay.
First of all, our guest this week is Chef Greg Prochel of Ferris Restaurant in New York City, relatively new restaurant, generating a lot of buzz, And we've eaten there.
I love that chicken.
We had a great time.
Which I know sounds strange, but the chicken's really good.
No, chicken is a hot thing again these days. The Sasso chicken, which is a special there, but something Greg got known for at his last restaurant, is a showpiece, which we'll talk about in a minute. Can we just talk for a second about our double lives?
Yes.
I'm feeling honest. I want to be honest. First of all,
Double life sounds a little sassy, but what did you mean by that?
It is a shared double life.
Okay.
There is our public life.
Yes.
The life that we lead on Instagram and Facebook. And then there is our real life. I just had to wake you up to do this intro.
And it was like 9:30 p.m.
It's not even 10 p.m. You were unconscious.
Yes.
Yes.
I work hard, Andrew.
We both work very hard. Yeah. I am just back from the first leg of my book tour, the weekly plug, my new book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, which is about the American chefs of the 70s and 80s, is now out. I did a four-day swing through Los Angeles. It started the morning after a book party that the great and generous Daniel Boulud threw for me. I don't understand that man. He's the greatest guy.
So charming. And lovely.
Not just charming. Threw a party. Threw a party. Gave his restaurant and provided the staff,
crazy, generous.
For a party. That was Monday night. We got home about 2 a.m. I got up and left for the airport at about 5 a.m. Flew to Los Angeles and commenced 4 days of media, which was exciting and wonderful. Also, completely exhausting. And back home here in Hastings, a Stephen King novel, as one of our friends said, began to play out in our little town. Tell people what happened in our town.
Okay. First of all, Andrew was away. I was working, doing kid stuff. And then we had a pack of rabid coyotes terrorize our little town.
A pack of rabid coyotes.
The kids could not even walk to school. They had to be driven in this. They had emergency dismissals. It was absolute chaos.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, there was that insane snowstorm.
Yeah, we had a nor'easter which knocked out my flight. I was on my way to have dinner. And for those of you who have read the book, there's a gentleman by the name of Bruce Martyr, a Los Angeles chef, who's on page one of the book. My last stop on my trip was I was going to have dinner with Bruce and his wife, Shelley.
Little did you know.
And the minute I slammed the trunk of my car, pulled away from the Nomad Hotel where I was staying in Los Angeles, made my first turn, I think, onto 6th Street, and within about a minute of pulling away from the hotel, a text popped up on my phone, which I only saw driving, for those of you who get mad about this kind of thing, because my phone was propped up on the dashboard giving me directions, and it said, your flight's been canceled. And I got stuck for the weekend in Los Angeles, and you were treated to two more days of
coyotes,
solo, coyotes,
snow,
down power lines.
It was crazy, Andrew. Yeah. It was. That's why I was sleeping on the couch. That's why I fell asleep.
That is our double life. So it's really fun though when we respectively get to live the other life. We spot each other. And each other to go have that other life that I was having.
Yeah, it's called a workation for a reason.
Yeah, I don't even call it that. I just call it fun.
Okay, fair enough. Fun it is.
This is not fun. I mean, I love everybody in this house, but fun, eh. Anyway.
We're having fun right now.
So Greg Prochel is this young chef. He worked, well, he's had many jobs, as all young chefs have. And then he was, for a while, under the auspices and tutelage of Carlo Maracci, the chef at Blanca, which is a 2-star tasting menu restaurant out back of Roberta's, which is actually the home base of Heritage Radio Network. That's where most shows broadcast. I record in the field, but that's Greg spent a lot of time there. He then was the chef at a restaurant called Le Turtle, a name that I still think is really funny. And that's where I first had Greg's food. You never had it there.
I've never had it there.
His that place was very successful. And then he just opened up in a hotel in the West 20s in New York City in the fall, Ferris, which is sort of a little jewel box of a restaurant. It's set down below street level in this hotel. It's dinner only. They serve... I mean, it's a hotel, so they take care of it. There's food available all the time in the lobby bar in that lounge area. But the restaurant itself is a little jewel box of a restaurant. It's dimly and very sexily lit. They have a fun drink program. They have some very cool wines. And they have Greg's very sort of the moment American menu. A lot of vegetables, pretty vegetable heavy, but all the proteins you would expect. As you said, he does a Sasso chicken, when it's available. It came with a schmaltz polenta, which was one of the richest. It was almost
I totally forgot about that side. That was delicious.
For people who know what pomme à l'ego is, this potato preparation, it almost was that rich. It was almost that rich. And he's got a repertoire of dishes. He does specials as well. It's all very... I want to say it's very original, but in a thoughtful way. It's not stupidly original like food can often be. It all makes sense. It's all delicious.
Well, it's not tortured.
Not in the least. Right. I mean, some of it's actually very simple. I mean, one of the dishes I loved, and it's not even a dish I usually like at all, there was a blood sausage we had the night I was there that had a lot of black pepper in it and just ate really well. He's got a real deft hand with salads. Real fluency with lettuces and greens. And we met recently. They were doing a bunch of stuff in the restaurant. They spotted us a hotel room. So if you see the picture on the episode page or the episode link on iTunes, you know, we're kind of crammed into this little desk, which it seems I've done a lot of interviews at kind of current chic boutique-y hotels, and the desk situation in all these places is very small. I mean, I guess you don't need a huge desk if you're staying in a room by yourself, you know, in a little lean-to at one of these places, but it makes for amusing photographs. There wasn't a lot of space between us in the photograph. But I think that's all I'm going to say about it. It's a pretty straight ahead interview, so you'll learn all about them in the piece. But that's it. Anyway, it's nice to be home. I'm going to be home for a week, and then I'll be in Philadelphia.
Be off again.
Philadelphia next week, and then back, and then.
May we not have coyotes?
I know. I don't know what's in store for us this week. It's a little stranger.
It's like a tornado.
It's a little stranger.
We're going to have a tornado coming.
It's a little Stranger Things-ish in our town. I mean, there might be a leprechaun invasion.
11 standing on our lawn.
11 on our lawn. The thing from It. I never saw It. What is it?
It's a clown.
Yeah, the clown has a name, though. Pennywise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pennywise could be outside our window listening to this.
All right, now you're scaring me. Let's get
strange
going.
Strange things are happening. I know. I hope our daughter doesn't hear this. She'll freak out. Okay. With all that, here is my interview with Chef Greg Prochel, recorded in Midtown Manhattan a few weeks ago. I hope you enjoy it. So before we get into your story, your backstory, can you just, I feel like as much as I think I understand guys who do what you do for a living, this moment that you're in right now is something that I really have a hard time putting myself in the headspace of or kind of envisioning what it's like to be in this moment. You did La Turtle before this, mm-hmm. got a lot of great attention there. Yep. You, now you're here, you've gotten already a really nice review.
Yeah.
I can see the way you just responded that that was meaningful and a relief as well.
You have no idea. Yeah.
Yeah. But you are also doing this incredibly, so you're kind of flush with success right now, right? Or the trappings of a good launch. And I'm going to knock wood since we're here in a hotel room or fake. I don't know what this is, But what is it like day to day? Like when you get up in the morning, are you able to enjoy this moment you're in? Are you still kind of in a constant state of pushing? Are you stressed out? Like just what's your kind of default headspace right now?
I mean, stressed out.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. I mean, stressed out. I mean, I think like, we run on stress. I think that's like kind of our gasoline. It's just like, it's like part of the job, but I like that. I like high stress.
Yeah.
Like moments. I mean, that's always been something that I really like. I think I thrive under that pressure and that's why I love this industry so much because you're constantly under it. And I think it brings out the best in people. I mean, it could bring out the best or the worst. If it's the worst, you're probably not going to last long in the industry.
Right.
If it brings out the best, like, you know, it pushes you to go on. And it's funny you say that because, you know, I've been on a very long string of just working because, opening a restaurant's like super exciting.
Yeah.
It's like every day is like amazing and like you keep getting better and better. And like we opened up pretty strong, I think. I think like our crew was really good. The food was pretty much almost exactly where I wanted it to be.
You knew what you wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean,
you had a strong sense of purpose.
We had a strong sense of what we wanted to do with the food. And as far as openings, I've been part of a few of them. As far as openings go, I mean, this one was pretty, I don't want to say easy because it's not the right word, but it was like, it's like kind of everything aligned very nicely for us. So like, I don't want to say it was an easy opening because it was definitely challenging like every opening is, but you know, it was...
You were able to execute your plan.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of...
No, I mean, there wasn't really that much outside interference. Like Charles, our operator was like, me and him are really, we formed a really close bond and we see eye to eye on a lot of things, which makes it so much easier to not have to try to explain your vision, just have someone kind of understand what you want to do.
Yeah.
So it's been like very smooth this so far. I mean, it's been smooth, relatively speaking, about restaurant opening.
Yeah.
But I mean, like my whole thing was like, all right, when you get the Wells review, hopefully that comes in soon. And it came in sooner than I thought. And
I was
super happy with it. I mean, really, really, really happy. I think it was a really nice review. And I think he understood what we were trying to get across. And that doesn't happen a lot.
What would that be if you had to put it to words to it?
Just like we want to have fun. Like, and like, that's, I know that's like a weird thing. And like when people try to talk about our cuisine, I'm like, our cuisine's exciting. And like, that's not a word to describe a cuisine at all, but it's what we want. It's what we cook. What we're excited about at the moment. We make drinks that, like that we're excited about. Jenny's putting wines on the list that she's excited about. And like, that's all like seasonal cooking and seasonal restaurants are, is it's about the excitement of a season. So,
so
that I think he got, and like, it's like not, we don't take ourselves too seriously. We take what we do very seriously, but not ourselves personally. And like the steps of service are very friendly and like fun. So like that all came together really just naturally. And like the room really speaks to it as well. And that was that was not planned. It was just like, it just kind of came about as just kind of aligning, which is really like kind of precious. And like, it doesn't happen like that at all a lot of the time.
It's funny that you say fun to me because we came on a double date, my wife and I, with a friend of ours. My friend Steven is, he's a veteran of the industry from the restaurateur side, from the front of the house. And we just had a blast. I mean, it's a very, it's a nice energy in the room. It's a little clubby, but without the attitude that implies. So you feel like you're in sort of this special place. I don't know how to put the right words to it. It does feel slightly exclusive because of the small scale.
And where it is, it's kind of hidden. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's none of that. Like I say, there's none of that attitude.
No pretension whatsoever.
Zero. We just had a blast. It was great music. Drinks were great. Food was awesome. And it was this place. Like, if I hadn't been there with my wife, it's the kind of place. Every once in a while, I'll go to dinner with friends, and I'll be like, this is where I'm bringing Kate the next night we go out on a date. And this would have been the place.
Yeah, I mean, like, last night, my buddy Galen, the CDC of Blanca, came in, and he had guests 2 nights ago mention that they came into Ferris. And they were from out of town, and they went to Blanca, and like they're like, yeah, we had a great meal. They're like, the vibe there is just like, it's just fun. Like, it's just great. Like, we sat at the counter, and like, I'm close enough to where I can like yell at you about stuff. Like, we're talking, having dialogues about stuff. And, you know, it's a small enough room where I can go out and touch tables and say hi to people, especially when they have questions and stuff. It's like, it's exactly kind of what I want in a restaurant. I mean, it's exciting. It's fun. It's personal, I think. I think it's really personal, which means a lot to me. And it's like great because I get to watch people enjoy. I mean, that at Blanca was like the best part of Blanca.
Right.
Besides everything else that was amazing about the place is that like you're serving people food and like you're literally can just creep on them and just like as you're prepping, just like, kind of look up from the top of your eyes and just stare at them and see their reaction. I mean, that's what I love about this. But like going back, like I thought that the Wells thing, I was like, this is going to be it. I was like, that comes in. Regardless of what it is, I'll finally get like, I'll take a little bit of time away just because I think it would be good. But then it came out and I was like, it just rejuvenates you with this kind of excitement of like, yeah, I could be like, all right, you know, review's done. I can take it easy. Yeah. Let's coast through the year. But it's like that review, like the energy in the kitchen, every cook, like there, it was just like, let's go. Like, what now? What next? Like
validation.
Let's keep going. So it's like, it's like that. It's kind of like a double edged sword where like that great thing comes in and it's like, all right, now we can relax. But it's like, no, like let's go, man. Like let's see what we can do next.
Push.
So like, am I enjoying it? It's funny because I thought about that like a couple of days ago when I woke up. It hit me like later that night. One of my chefs mentioned to me like that he got that review and like he's my number two guy and he's been in it since the beginning and been pushing really hard and he's like I just started crying and I was like he's like I don't know why and I was like dude I understand man I was like that it hit me later that night like everything that we've done like and we've worked really hard for this like we both have been killing ourselves for this so like I mean it is one man's review it is just
yes
it is just one thing but like that validation it was very nice like because we wanted to get a good review because we just owed it. I think we owed it to like everyone that we've been working with, all the cooks, like every single person that's been part of this. We've been working hard to get that validation from like a major publication. And for it to be Wells in the first one was great. I mean, we were really happy with it.
Yeah.
Like super happy. So like I am enjoying, I mean, I'm a pretty happy guy pretty much all the time. Like I enjoy everything. So did I enjoy that? Yeah, I mean, of course I did. Am I like kind of like slap myself on the back like good job? Not really. I'm just kind of like I can't wait to do more. Like I can't like you know we're not done yet.
It's also a luxury. You don't. I mean, maybe you could have personally, and anyone in the industry knows this, right? People who listen who aren't in the industry maybe don't. Once you get the first couple of big reviews, it's very common that the chef starts taking a night or two off a week, or there's an exhale. It's understandable, and if they're good at what they do, they have a team who can shouldn't affect anything, but they want to be there and have their hand on everything until that happens.
Yes.
I mean, it's again, industry people know this. If the chef happens not to be there, I mean, I've seen chefs be at a charity event, you know, in the first month or two, and they get a text from the restaurant that so-and-so critic just came in, and they're gone. There's like a cloud of smoke, and they're in their kitchen, you know, cooking for that person. That's what happens.
Yeah.
But that aside, you know, the business you guys are in, you can't let up. I mean, you can't take a victory lap. There's people coming to dinner within 12 hours of when you read the review, and there's no, you know, you don't get to just coast. Everything has to get prepped that day. Everything has to get executed that day.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and like, to me, it's like, it's one of those things. It's like, I don't know if this is not the right way to think, but like I feel like I owe it to the guests to be there. I mean, not that my team can't handle it, but like I think I bring a personality there that like, and then people want to maybe see me like do stuff and like they want to talk to me and they want to like congratulate, so I gotta be there.
Yes.
Like, you know, I want to be there. Like the night that the review came out online, so on that Tuesday, Gunner from Gurn came in, and he was like, he came in, I believe, with, I think it was his wife, and they had, like, a great time, and, like, we talked for a while, and, like, he remembered when I went to a Gurn, geez, it must have been, like, 22 months ago, when I was at La Turtle, and, like, he remembered me being there, and, like, it was just, like, you know, it was, like, it's respect from your peers, I think, is the most important thing in this whole thing. It's, like, that's, you know, I want to beat every chef. Like, I want to be the best chef in the world. That's what that's my drive every day. Is that going to happen? Probably not. I mean, I'm realistic, but I want to try to do that. So, like, when I have, like, industry people coming in, especially, like, other chefs, it's like, you know, I want to be, like, I want to leave them with, like, damn, like, why didn't I think of that? Because that's, like, that's the best thing about when I go out and eat is, like, I'll have a dish and I'm just like, God damn it. I was like, why did I not think of that?
Yeah.
Like, why,
or how does, or how why do they did do I, that? Yeah, how why, do they
why
do
did
that?
I not think of that combination? It's genius. Yeah. And like, that's the thing I love about it. It's like, you know, there is that always that like friendly, competition within it. It's like every, you know, especially with an ingredient, when like something seasonal comes out, like, you know, I hate to use the example of ramps, but you know, that's like the biggest thing.
It's about
like,
ramps?
Yeah. Ramps. Like, it's like, what are they going to do? Oh, we're going to grill and put on something. No, like let's do something that someone's going to be like, what? Like, why did I not think of that?
Yeah.
And like, that's what we're constantly pushing for. I mean, at the end of the day, I think our food is pretty like homey. I think it's like pretty like, just like soul satisfying. It is very, I think, unique and creative, but like it reads way more difficult than it is. Cause it's like, our food is pretty much just, it's pretty
accessible.
Simple. Yeah. But
I use the word relatable.
Yeah. That's a very good word. And I mean, I think that's very true. It's just like, you know, we maybe use some different combinations, but like, that's the fun of it. It's like, like putting things together. You're like, no way. Like,
well, to your point about being there, there were two moments that stood out for me from our night. One was, and I don't know if they did this because they knew that you and I sort of barely, but knew each other a little bit and that I was a writer, but when it was, we ordered the Sasso chicken. And they told me you were about to like break it down, and maybe I wanted to come look.
Oh no, they tell everybody.
Do they?
Yeah, they tell
everybody. So I came over.
That's also one of the things. Sorry to interrupt you there, but that's like, okay. I mean, we try to treat everyone that comes in the door like that. Like, I mean, it's funny because we had actually run in with a ex girlfriend of a reviewer, and she was like, "Oh, she's like, so do you know who I was?" And we were like, no, one of the servers met her. We just ran into her at a bar and was like, "Oh, hey, you've been to Ferris a few times," and like. And it ended up being an ex-girlfriend of a reviewer. And she's like, oh, I thought you knew who I was. And she's like, they're just like, no, that's just, that's just what
that's
we,
great.
That's just what we do. And that's exactly what we want to do all the time.
That's great. So, as it should be, but rarely is. But what I was going to say was, I came over and videoed, I don't know if you even knew I was shooting it.
Yes.
But I videoed it and I put it online on my Instagram. And first of all, you're you know, about you being there. I mean, you have created this scenario. We had the first episode of the season was Missy Robbins talking about the open kitchen at Lilia. And like, she said, you know, I didn't mean to, but I put myself on a stage.
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
you have
yes,
created a frame where if you are not there, it's clearly someone else. I mean, it's very apparent if you're not there. But the funny thing about that video was I had just an incredible number of views. And there was a comment that popped up from Barbara Lazaroff, do you know that name?
Of course.
Barbara's the now ex-wife, but still in some respects business partner of Wolfgang Puck, was responsible for the most famous first open kitchen in the United States. She designed the original Spago. And did you see the comment she put? She wrote a comment that said, amazing video. I don't know if the word was amazing, but amazing video. I could have kept watching. And I thought, that's an amazing person to have see that, you know, someone who's
of course.
I mean, there's like a dotted line from what they did to what you do.
Yeah, I think that's
just kind of amazing.
I think that's really cool. I mean, the whole idea of it, I always want to have the open kitchen. Not necessarily to put on a show, but like I want people to take a step aside of what we do. I mean, there's like so many intricacies of like what we do. And like you saw like that, it's just a chicken. I mean, it's a really good one. We love treat it really well.
But also the schmaltz polenta.
Yeah, that's pretty serious. it's taking something creamy and fatty and adding even more fat. I mean, how do you go wrong?
Right.
But Yeah, like that idea of that open is just like, I don't know. It's just kind of, to me, it's like, it's just so cool. I mean, I loved like when I ate at Olmsted the first time.
Yeah.
It's like they sat me, I was there on day 5 of their opening.
Yeah.
So I kind of saw like all the writing on the wall. I was like, this place is going to be so successful.
Yes.
Like, and I had the carrot crepe like I said, day 5, and I was like, God damn. I was like, this, and like, I love carrots.
Yes.
Carrots are in a lot of my food.
Yeah.
And I was like, damn. I was like, no, I'm never going to be able to do something like this, because it's just like, it was so good. And I mean, that will probably be on the menu forever there, because it should
that's
be.
So funny. I don't know if you like, know the backstory, yeah, but that was like a last second improv almost.
That's
not it. Like day of, but he was.
Do you know that's the
he was looking for what am I going to do with this?
The Wakamomo peach and the yuzu froyo dessert was last second.
Yeah.
It was literally put on, I think, a day or two before we opened.
That's
here.
Amazing.
It was because I had these little baby peaches, these unripe peaches,
yeah,
at a Izakawa. It was with like a miso cod,
yeah,
which it's like, that's like one of my favorite things in the world. I know it's like so like played out and so old school, but like,
yeah,
I love it. And it was that, and it was like, there's this, the green orb, and I was like, why would they put an olive with it?
Yeah.
And then I ate it, and I was like, what is that? And the lady told me, she was like, oh, it's a Wakamomo peach. And I was like, oh. I was like, why would you put that with it? And then I tried, and I was like, God, I was like, I need this in my life. It took me like a month and a half to find them, to track them down,
right,
to find a purveyor. And then like, we got them in, we got them in, and we tried them, and we're like, oh, these are so good. Like the texture, everything is like,
yeah,
everything about that ingredient, like I love it. It's like exactly, it's just like the whole story behind why they do it. And
yeah,
it's like, it's such a cool ingredient. So then immediately I was like, all right, now we got to put a dessert.
Yeah.
And then we're just like, let's make it easy. Like,
yeah,
ice cream, olive oil, that.
Yes.
That's it. Like,
yeah,
and like, it's funny. It's like those things happen, I think, way more than you know. Like,
yeah,
I think, right, like, it's like, oh, we need to fill a void, or like,
yeah,
there's a spot in the menu we need to like hit. And it's like something comes about, and then you try it, and it's just like, whoa, like, well, all right, yeah, this is really good.
I often compare it to, you know, like low-budget filmmaking. There's all these amazing Hollywood stories of these things that happened out of like, oh, it was raining that day and we had to do this, and then some classic scene comes up. These moments of necessity can cause a spark of recognition or a spark of inspiration. It's interesting to me. But the other thing I was going to mention, though, so the open kitchen was one thing about you being there, and I had that great,
yes,
moment of coming over and watching that.
Yeah, a lot
and
of people have videos of me coming to steaks, and like one of my favorites is a video that a friend of mine posted of the chicken, and it's like it basically exemplifies everything that we try to do in the kitchen, like the vibe we try to put. It's like a very serious, like just like very focused, like,
yeah,
putting everything in place for the chicken, getting ready to break it down. And then I leave the screen for a second, and I come back, I know someone's filming me, and I just like kind of bend down and just throw up the deuces and like smile. And it's like exactly what we want. Like in the flip of a switch, like,
yeah,
we go from very serious to like extremely fun.
Yes.
And like that's what I think the good thing about the open kitchen is too, because I don't know, we have a lot of fun working in that kitchen.
That's
like,
great.
We, like, with the guys, like, and we have a real lot of fun, and we try to have that. And, like, I think that shows through the vibe, and I think it shows through the food. So, like,
yeah,
that's what the open kitchen, I think, really means to me,
well,
is that it shows fun.
Also, I feel like your kitchen is just open enough.
Like, yeah,
you're in the front, the guys are in the back, but it's not, like, it's not a crazy show.
No.
But the other thing I was going to say, you talked about when, you know, when you're there, you're able to have these moments with colleagues, right? Now, I'm not a chef, ever have been, or a cook, not a professional cook. But we had a conversation at the end of the night. I came up to you and I said,
yes,
do you remember this?
Yes,
and I said,
yes,
I
about
said,
the blood sausage.
About, well, but more broadly about black pepper.
Yes.
And I said that I love black pepper. And there were two dishes that night. One was your blood sausage, and one was that schmaltz polenta, mm-hmm, that comes with the
pepper.
Chicken.
Yep, just black pepper.
And I said, you know, you really take the black pepper to the brink, but in a way that I love. I happen to love that flavor. It's something I do a lot in my own cooking. I like coarse ground black pepper.
It's the best.
In risotto, I like it. I mean, I use it a lot if I think it'll fit somewhere. And I said, I hope this doesn't seem like a crazy thing. And you told me this actually went back to an earlier job that you had. And
Carlo Maracci really,
who's the chef at Blanca.
Who's the chef at Blanca.
Yeah.
He told me how to use pepper. And it's like,
yeah,
it's funny, like our stations had pepper grinders.
Yeah.
And we had crunchy salt, like just like mauled in or whatever.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of different olive oils, actually.
Yeah.
But we had, you know, acid. That's it. Like,
right,
we had lemon wedges.
Yes.
Sometimes lime. Bergamot, if it was in season, we had a lot of acid and like
these were the
acid,
finishing elements
acid
at the pass.
And pepper. And that's
yeah,
and on my pass, I have many different finishing ingredients, not a crazy amount, but we have our pepper grinder. Our pepper grinder, and like the thing that's, I think, that I really like about the pepper finish is like we actually make a blend. We make a blend of telecherry, which are just like just normal peppercorns.
That's what most people know as black pepper. Yeah, that's the default.
And sometimes if you get some really high quality ones, they keep them on the vine a little bit longer, so it picks up a little bit stronger flavor. And we mix ours with a little bit of grains of paradise, which I love. I love. So that's like
okay. It's that
like,
I didn't pick up. Yeah, that's so great.
Like, but it's like, but like that's like it's in the. It's actually I think technically in the ginger family.
I was going to say, and does that like brighten it in a subtle way?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of makes it just a little more floral. So like it's like it's like three parts of telecherry to like one part of grains of paradise, and
interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just like that pepper is like just good, and it's funny because I hated it forever. My whole life,
what,
like my
pepper?
My dad used to put it on everything.
Like, he had
I would
a heavy
put it on
hand.
Eggs. My dad would put it on his like potatoes, and I'm just like, pepper's gross. Like I was like, I don't like it. And then it's funny because like out of nowhere, you know, your tastes change a lot.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite dishes during the holidays is my grandparents. Now just my grandmother makes this like liver ball soup where it's like egg whites and liver, calf's liver, and marjoram. That's it, and it's in a broth. Of like of just like these a beef bone broth.
Yeah,
it's like this most simplest thing, and it's just like these quenelles of the liver that are just poached in its own consomme.
Yeah,
and the best finishing part is it's a shit ton of pepper and parsley. That's it.
That's
and like
it.
And like I never knew that like that pepper is really like to me that like that's the rug that brings the room together. I mean it like it really adds that spiciness, and it just like adds floral. Like to me, it's like one of the greatest spices. And like, it's funny because a lot of the cooks, like when they start here, they're like, you like black pepper a lot. I was like, yeah, it's on everything. It's like, it's finished on almost everything because it's just, I love it. And I think it's like, we try to bring it to the point. Like when you salt something, you bring it to like just below the point where it's salty. Yeah. Like it brings out all the flavor. And like, especially when like you have like really good pepper and you can make a nice blend. It's like, it sounds silly that with all the stuff that's going on, all the great ingredients, but sometimes, you know, things just need a little pepper.
Well,
and that's
it's taken for granted. It is taken for granted. It's something that a lot of young cooks, I think, need to have trained out of them. Because I remember years ago, Bill Telepan saying to me that he never understood why salt and pepper was like a default. And like when he cooks like in the spring, you know, and does a lot of these kind of, you'd mentioned ramps before, but when it's like asparagus, peas, ramps, all that stuff, Bill has a lot of food where there's no pepper.
Yeah.
Right? Which I get, but properly deployed, it is just such a high value spice. I want to ask before I forget, do you, and I always say this is a chef show, not a cooking show or a food show, but I have to ask, do you toast that mix of peppercorns?
No.
Or do you just go raw?
No, I just go raw.
So they don't need...
I go raw, but okay. For in the...
Because some people say toasting will intensify.
Yes, it absolutely does. It activates the oil and stuff.
Yeah.
For a spice mix that we do on our duck, we do toast them. For the spice mix that goes into the blood sausage, absolutely gets toasted.
Uh-huh.
The regular pepper grinders, we just use raw.
Got it.
Keep it simple.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, we also like, we use a lot of different varieties of peppercorns. Yeah. We use a lot. One of our great producers, purveyors called Strega. They give us our microgreens, and they also provide us with a lot of our peppercorns and interesting ones like our tamir, which is like a berry from Nepal.
Yes.
And it's like it has like this Szechuan like tendency that we put in our yogurt, and that's amazing. We have this other stuff called tamiz, which is like it literally kind of it smells like a cigar. It's like super smoky and earthy. We use that in a lot of stuff. We use that actually to finish the chicken. So it's like tamiz, it's a little porcini powder and a little bit of Maldon salt and just regular pepper. And it's like just, there's so many different types of pepper out there that like I haven't even touched. And like everyone I find, I'm just like, it's amazing. And like the tamir is amazing because it's like, it almost tastes like grapefruit. Like the scent, like when I open the container, it's like, I just get this hit of like freshly zested grapefruit. And it's just like, it's like amazing that like these ingredients exist and like I haven't heard about them in and now. And then like that's also one of the great things about cooking is like every day I'm amazed by like cool stuff that like I had no idea about.
But the other thing about these little micro decisions that you're describing is so when people look at the food, it doesn't seem terrible overcomplicated, but it tastes very distinct and it's these decisions. There's, you know, I didn't even pick up on it, but that a quarter of the pepper is I'm sorry, what was it?
Grains of paradise.
Grains of paradise.
Yeah. the greatest name that also makes, for yes, ingredient.
Can't go wrong. But that makes a difference. I mean, yeah, like, I mean, that little, and the fact that probably that you don't toast it, maybe it'd be too intense.
I mean, I think everyone has, you know, are trying to find their identity and like, and like, I think mine is like, maybe mine's a little bit like on under the radar, and like, I'm okay with that. I mean, as long as people enjoy it. And like, the thing is, that's cool about the food as well, is I think it's like cool that like, sometimes you don't know why you enjoy something. Yeah. It's just like, it's just good.
Yes.
Like, it's just like, you're like, why do I like it? I don't know. It's just really good. Like, yeah. It makes me happy. I don't know. Like, I don't know what else to say. So like, so I think if like, you know, like some of these decisions are kind of unconscious, like it's just like it seems to make sense, but a lot of our stuff is really well thought out. Like, like we use these things because we like grapefruit in that dish. And like, do we want to just put grapefruit zest? No, but we found this peppercorn that tastes like grapefruit and it like has this interesting quality that like it changes the way you taste while you're eating it. So, I mean, like, I think all those little things, they, you know, the devil's in the details.
Totally.
And we have a lot of devils in the kitchen. Uh-huh. We have a lot of details that are unwritten, but like, it's funny. It's it was one of the first dishes I did at EMP, and there was such a small amount of cayenne that it was like, we had to use like what we call the crack scale. Like it was like the one that goes like a hundredth of a gram. And it was such a small amount that went into this. And like, I didn't understand it at the time because I was like, I was training a cooking. He's like, why do we put some a little? I was like, we just put it in so we know it's in there, but no one else knows it's in there. And it's like, there was a reason for it to be that small amount. Like that's what the chef decided was the right amount, and that's what he liked. And there was a reason behind it. So like, it's like all these little things that are really important that may not make a big difference, but then like when you have a guest that like you said, like when you understood, like I just seasoned that polenta the way that I like it. Like I wanted to add spice without adding heat, and like you picked up on it. So like, in of your meal, like I succeeded. I did what I wanted to do. Yeah. I wanted you to notice stuff that maybe is not really
mission accomplished. You know, I remember as we're going through these dishes. I mean, I have a pretty good taste memory, but I vividly remember the flavor, but also I would say the calibration. That's the word I would use. Okay, we are going to take a break. We are talking with Chef Greg Prochel of Ferris Restaurant in New York City. In a hotel room above the restaurant. And before we go to break, if anyone out there is interested, this space could be yours. We don't have a sponsor. We have a huge and growing industry following and people who have chefware companies, knife companies, cooking schools, chefs and future chefs are our audience. Get in touch. We need a sponsor. Heritage has been quite understanding of it, but it's kind of a shame. So reach out to us on that. And also, if you'd like to follow the show and keep up on new episodes, @ChefPodcast is the handle on Instagram, Twitter, and also on Facebook. We'll be right back. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like the penny bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Come for the food, stay for the friends. Fine Diners Over 40 is a members-only dinner club for singles and couples who enjoy dining at highly rated restaurants and sharing the experience with others. Fine Diners Over 40 appreciate food as art, as cultural adventure, as scientific experiment, and best of all, food as an opportunity to take pleasure in the company of others. Join them for culinary and social adventures in New York and Seattle. Food may be the main attraction at Fine Diners Over 40 events, but it is the friendly and interesting members who carry the day. Join them for an evening of fine dining, fun, and stimulating conversation. While enjoying innovative tasting menus by first-rate chefs, you'll talk movies, theater, pets, sports, travel, and more. Epicurus said it best. We should look for someone to eat and drink with before looking for something to eat and drink. Learn more at finediners40.com. That's finediners40.com. Better keep it at least
an arm's length away. You're gonna get... And we are back talking with Chef Greg Prochel of Ferris Restaurant in New York City. So, Greg, let's shift gears.
Sure.
I want to get your story. So, can you take me back? Where'd you grow up?
Northern New Jersey, Bergen County. I grew up
Bergen County.
Grew up in Westwood, New Jersey.
Okay, what kind of childhood? Like, what did your folks do?
My mom, stay-at-home mom. My dad was a stockbroker. Uh-huh. Very, very strict business.
Came into the city every day?
He came into the city actually a little bit when he was younger, but like now he's kind of stayed in New Jersey.
Oh, nice.
Which is nice. And now he's like kind of working from home now.
Nice.
He's semi-retired, except I think I definitely get my work ethic from him. I don't think he'll ever retire. Like, I think he's just like a guy who wants to work and like for his job, he could do it wherever. So, but yeah, he was very sports strict, which I love. He got me playing every sport known to man.
Organized?
Yeah.
School teams or school, higher
school,
level than that?
School and also Pop Warner. I mean, we were the Westwood Wolverines.
Yeah.
That probably is why I was like infatuated with X-Men growing up.
Uh-huh.
Is
that why you have the beard? Is that why you grew the beard?
The beard and the big hair, yeah. I'm trying to look like him.
No, but really, is that why?
No. I think that's a whole other story. This is only a last like 3 year thing.
Uh-huh.
I always had to be like cleanly shaven.
Is that
like,
right?
High school, I went to an all boys Catholic high school, Bergen Catholic, in Oradell, New Jersey, and I had to be cleanly shaven. My sideburns had to go no farther than halfway down your ear. So
you had a strict childhood.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't mean crazy strict, but
it was weird. Like I don't know. Like it's funny because I mean I just got detention all the time because like I, if you noticed, I have a lot of hair and it grows very thick and also a completely different color than my normal hair, which is also weird. But like I would shave in the morning and like you know by like 3 o'clock as like a 16-year-old kid, like I would have like some stubble and I would always get detention. And the big, do you shave? I was like, yes, I shave.
I had
this
a friend
morning.
Like that in high school. Yeah. Roger Bauman, if you listen to this show, I'm thinking of you.
Yeah. Just like the Wolfman. Like you'd see him after lunch and it'd be a different person.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was interesting. But I played sports there. I played, actually, I got to play football at Wesleyan University, went to college. That's a bigger reason why I went there until.
What position?
I was offensive guard, and then I switched to tight end, and then I destroyed my shoulder, reconstructive shoulder surgery on my right shoulder.
Was there a particularly traumatic moment, or was it just wear and tear over the years?
It was wear and tear over the year, but dope for a pass and just shoulder, like almost completely behind my head. Yeah, that was a bad one. I was in a cast that was almost like a soft cast. I was like. Basically kept my arm, like, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance stance, like, all the time.
For how long?
I was supposed to be in it for 3.5 months. After, like, 5 weeks, I just took it off because I was like, I can't deal with this anymore. I was like, I couldn't do anything. Like, I couldn't do anything. So, like, my left hand is, like, very not skilled with a lot of things.
To this day?
No, I mean, cooking has made it actually, made it much better.
It has. I was going to say that, but what about?
You have to have the dexterity, like, in the left hand as well. Like, I mean, that's your guide for your knife. So, that was hard to do. But, like, always, my left hand, I can't do anything with it. I can dribble a basketball with it, but that's about it.
A lot of cooks, have shoulder injury. That's one of the most common things. Lower back comes up a lot. Are you okay on that?
I'm great.
You're
now.
Good.
Well, the first 2 weeks, my first job was at EMP.
That's 11 Madison Park.
Yeah, that's it's pretty easy kitchen to work in.
that was your first kitchen
joking.
Job?
Yeah, I was the stage there. That was my first time in a professional kitchen to stage there to work for free to finish my culinary school, because we had to do an externship.
Yeah.
So that was my – I staged there, and I was like, oh, this is awesome. I was like, this is exactly what I want to do. And when I started there for my externship, like the first 2 weeks, I was like, I've made a terrible mistake, like parts of my body. Cause I was in finance before that for 2.5 years. So I was sitting at a desk and going from that to literally just getting the crap kicked out of you for a good portion of the day. I was like, there was parts of my body that I didn't know I had that hurt. Yeah. I mean, that was tough. I mean, but it was like, it was a pretty easy transition. I'm not gonna lie. Like, I mean, I feel fine. I mean, if you notice my chef's pass, I made it pretty high. Specifically, I mean, being a tall guy in the kitchen is tough. Most surfaces like that you're cutting on are pretty low.
Interesting.
But I mean, like shoulder, like back, I feel great now, which is funny. I think because you're doing it every day. Like when I have days off, the first day back is tough.
Yeah. It's like going back to the gym after a break.
And like that also has helped me. I mean, I go to the gym pretty much every day in the morning. I mean, I try to go 5 or 6 times a week and run, bike, and weightlift. And I mean, it's just like, I think.
So when you come to work, you're already sort of loosened up, warmed up.
I feel good. I feel good, but then usually around like 3, I'm just like, oh, God, I need another quart of coffee to come right into the day. But, sorry, I kind of went off a tangent.
No, but like, I want to, can I back you? Yeah. Because I don't want to get too far away from it. So, but when you were a kid, what kind of, I mean, beyond the fact that you were an athlete,
I was a lunatic.
You were setting.
I have so many scars on my forehead. I ran through like the glass door at like Garden State Plaza when I was like 9, had like a ton of stitches. I got hit with a golf club because we were hitting like golf balls in my friend's backyard. Like I was a disaster.
Were you like hyperactive?
Very much. I have like really bad ADHD. Like you I can't sit still. Like
did anyone figure that out when you were a kid? Yes.
I think they figured that out pretty early. Okay. I was always a builder. Like I loved Legos more than anything like that. Yeah. I always wanted to do something with my hands because like that's what brought me joy. Like I drew, I always built stuff. Like just doing stuff with my hands was something I always wanted to
this
do.
This phrase that, well, first of all, the ADHD also, but that phrase you just said comes up so often with people who end up in kitchens. I like doing things with my hands. Yeah. I like working with my hands. That is something that I hear probably in 85-90% of the biographical interviews I do with people.
I mean, I'm not surprised by that at all. I mean, that's all we do. All we do are like, We have two things to utilize. We have time and we have our hands. Like we have to make those things work together. That's what this job is. I mean, like, and paying attention. That's
right.
It's like, it's funny. It's like, that's all, to me, that's all cooking is. It's just like, you just have to pay attention to stuff. That's it. Like if you can pay attention to a few things at the same time, you're going to be probably a pretty good cook. If you can season well, like if you have a decent palate, like just pay attention. Like pay attention to everything that's going on around you. Like a sense of awareness is the biggest thing that I learned in this industry is just you have to have a sense of awareness of everything that's going on because that's, you know, that's when things fall apart.
Yeah.
But, I was crazy. God bless my parents. I mean, I don't know how they dealt with me. I was always in trouble. I was always like running around. I was always getting hurt. I was always the kid that had like scrapes on his like knees. Cause I was just like, I don't know. I always wanted to climb stuff. I just had a never ending, like motor. Like I always wanted to do
school. School was hard for you?
No. I mean, it was actually pretty easy. I just hated it. Yeah. I surprisingly did very well in school. I mean, like well enough to get into Wesleyan, which was a really good college.
So you were smart enough to do well. Weren't an A student, but
I was a pretty straight A student.
Really?
I mean, I think I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I was smart enough to not have to work at school. Does that make sense?
It does, but that sounds to me like you probably have a natural. Have you ever had an IQ test?
Yeah.
Are you like off the charts?
No, not off the charts.
But you're pretty high.
I'm pretty high, but I mean, I don't know. I'm a simple guy. But I didn't study. Like I studied like the night before. I was that guy.
But you could do that and succeed.
But that's the thing. I think the pressure thing is that like I needed like the crap. Like
you
I
need
a test
like
tomorrow.
The hot breath of time on your neck. Like
like I need to like get a like study 5 chapters of like algebra like right now, and then I would be like, all right, well I'll just do that. And like I never really slept. Like
this is that adrenaline addiction that so many cooks have.
Yeah, and I don't sleep. Like I don't. It's not healthy, but like. It works. Like
what do you mean by don't sleep?
I like sleep like 4 or 5 hours a night, and I feel good. Like if I get 5 hours, like if I go to bed at 2, I wake up at 7. I'm like, right, I'm ready to go. Like I feel good.
You must if you're able to go to the gym in the morning.
I mean, so I don't know. I don't know how to relax. That's what I think my problem is.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah. I mean, my relaxing is going home and kind of reading a cookbook, which is like funny because it's just like it's so. It's like this career, like, it's so funny that, like, I never liked doing finance. It just never was something that interests me. I mean, I didn't feel like I was doing anything good. I was an analyst, so, like, I was on a lot of Excel. But, like, I just didn't feel like I was doing anything.
Why'd you start down that road?
My dad wanted me to. Uh-huh. He definitely wanted me to, like, at least, I mean, I worked very hard to get to do my major in college. It was economics, which is funny to go to a liberal arts school and do that. But they had actually a really good program. And
you were good at that?
I was good at numbers. I'm very good at numbers. Like, numbers interest me a lot. Just doing it as a full-time job didn't interest me.
No.
But
did you have the same attraction? I was really good at math. You know what I loved about it? I was an English major, which is a different thing.
Usually that's like a different brain.
Well, it was useless. I just was innately good at math. I just was good at
it. It's funny because that's me and my sister. My sister's a lawyer, and she was always good at English and anything with literature. And I hated that. And she was good with history. And she was terrible with math, and I was good with math.
So I was really good at math, although I didn't particularly care for it. But what I liked about it was that there was only one right answer.
Yeah, no gray area.
That you could be right. You and I were talking during the break about whether or not we would try to convince someone. If someone liked a restaurant that we thought was crap, would we get into an argument with them about it, right? And try to convince them otherwise. You don't have that with math.
No, you don't.
There's one answer.
Yeah, there's one answer. And it's also problem solving. I think that's also something I like about this industry. I mean, like, it's funny. People are like, "Well, what's your day to day like?" I was like, "You just put out fires all day." Like when you're a chef or a sous chef, like all you do is like you just put out. There's no perfect day. I mean, we all try to strive for that perfect day. Yeah. And it's non-existent. It's definitely non-existent.
Yeah.
There's a lot of days that are as close to that as possible as that we can get, but it's just like we're just putting out like problems. Like, oh, this product came in like this. Like this is roasting weird. Like the kabocha is not getting soft enough to where we can peel it, but at the same time, maybe if it's too soft, then it falls apart. Like there's so many things that are going on that are literally just problems. It's just like, and that's, I mean, I don't think that's unique to New York,
no.
But it's like, that's like why I think like if you can cook in New York in like tight confined spaces with these like crazy just rules from every single like governing body, like if we're able to make this happen, like, geez, like you can do it anywhere. But I mean, problem solving, I think, is a big thing that that you need to learn because I mean, like, stuff's gonna go wrong.
So like, what drew you to this? Like, where did food fit into your childhood?
It was a big part. My family definitely wanted to have. It was always like we had meals like at the table, like together. Uh-huh. Me, my sister, my mom, my dad. We did that
every
a lot,
night,
as much as possible until like. Uh-huh. Until I was an adolescent.
until
I was like, screw you, mom and dad.
Until the APBs started going out.
I'm too cool. I got to go hang out with my friends.
Right.
My son is at
that moment right now.
Oh, good luck with that.
Yeah, I've given up.
But, that was a big part. Breakfast, like on the weekends, was like big, which I really love. And that's like why I really don't like brunch. Like, I think breakfast, I think that weekend stuff is like very personal. Like, we are on like tight friends. Like, I really like that. And also just my grandparents on my mom's side, they grew up in Wyckoff. They lived in Wyckoff. That's where my mom grew up part of her life after they moved out of Brooklyn. We had a lot of meals there as a kid.
Did you help cook as a kid?
Oh, yeah. I always wanted to. And also, I was pretty particular. Not necessarily, I don't think, picky. I mean, I was picky, but not like crazy picky. But I definitely was particular.
You knew what you wanted. You knew what you liked.
I knew what I wanted. And I knew, like, there were some things that my mom did that I hated the way she did them.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, mom, because I know she's going to listen to this. But... like that's why I started cooking for myself. Like when I was young, like
how young?
Probably like 12, 13.
You were allowed to use the stove and a knife and all that stuff.
Yes, my favorite thing was making bacon, egg, and cheeses. That was my favorite thing.
Uh-huh.
And I still love those today.
What was your trick?
Nothing. I just did it the way I did it.
Yeah.
And I put. That's when I started putting lots of pepper on my bacon as I was cooking, and lots of pepper on my eggs. That's what I loved. Yeah, I always like spice, and I always want to do other stuff. But I mean, we had but the trick is sourcing good product, and that was Goldberg's Bagels in Westwood, New Jersey. Still to this day, the best bagel I've ever had.
Is that right?
Every time they have one actually where my parents used to live in Ringwood. So every time they come in and visit, I'm always like, bring me a dozen bagels.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw them in my freezer. I can have them at all times.
That's great.
I always have them. But yeah, I mean, my grandparents, I always try to learn from them, watch them, help them cook.
What was the background ethnically of your family?
They are from Germany. My grandmother, Germany, my grandfather, Austria. Then my grandfather moved to Germany when he was young. So they emigrated right before World War II, wisely enough to get out of there. And he came with my grandmother. They were married at 18 and 21. They moved across the world. And he came with his two brothers. And it's funny you mentioned
the U.S.
to the U.S. Wow. And they moved right to Brooklyn.
Oh my gosh.
And he became friends with a lot of people at Peter Luger's, a lot of like Italian families there. And I think that's where he learned like
to cook. A lot of people like who worked in the dining room.
Yeah. And like that's where he learned how to cook, I think. I mean, I think I knew he knew how, but like that was like a big part of it. And he always loved it. This is my grandfather. Like his whole life was like wine and food. Like that's what he wanted. That's what he wanted to do. They always they were always cooking at holidays. We'd always go there just for random nights, like where I'd want to go out and like hang out with my friends, my parents. Like we're going to our grandparents.
Yeah,
and I was like, I'd be mad because like I can't go out and like hang out with my friends, but I'd be like, well, I know I'm gonna get really
look
good.
At your eyes really, just yeah, lit up really when good, you said that.
There's certain things it saddens me. I mean, luckily, before he passed, like I talked to him a lot about food. Like when
did you?
Yeah, because I wanted to get all his recipes and like all of his techniques. And there's still stuff that I never will be able to do, and it saddens me that I won't be able to because I just don't know it. And
what, like what do you mean certain
just,
things
just,
he
just
didn't
certain
teach
ingredients,
you?
Yeah, that he can't teach me anymore. So like
can I ask what one of them was?
Well, it was weird. Like they did this thing with chanterelle. So like they had some land up in Vermont. They bought it like for like pennies in like the 60s.
Yeah.
When they actually moved into New Jersey, and we used to forage for mushrooms, and like that was like, I wish I cared more about food when I was like younger, because like I was like doing something that like people are doing now, and it's like the coolest thing. Like they'd have to wake me up at like 7 a.m. Like, when I'd be in Vermont, and I'd be like, do we really have to wake up and do this?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to do this. I want to go swimming.
Yes.
And they'd be like, no, we're going to go forage for some mushrooms. And we'd get, like, baskets and baskets full of amazing mushrooms. And, like, chanterelles specifically have a really distinct memory because they would can them in, like, this cream sauce. So, like, I would see all these, like, jars of, like, cream, like, this, like, cream sauce with mushrooms. I was like, there's no way that that's, like, okay or healthy.
Can and them sterilize them with the suction and keep them forever at room temperature.
And they always had a dehydrator, and they were always dehydrating stuff. And like he has this one dish of like just this mushroom sauce using that like that fermented mushroom, like that like the like the like it's because I guess it's just lacto fermentation. I mean, I'm assuming that's what it was. It was just some salt and some cream, and like it was like it made the greatest sauce I've ever had in my life. And like he does that, and like I don't know what that was, but like you said, you have a good taste memory. I mean, that's everything I cook is there's a few things that we just create just because we want to play around with stuff, but a lot of it is based on taste memory. I mean, that's
going
like,
all the way back to there.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, that's the culmination of this restaurant, like this specific one is like, this is probably the best example of me, of like who I am, of what like I like and what I've liked, and like and inspiration, and people that have made a very big impact on my life, and like what they've brought to my attention of like food. It's just like that's what I want to do. It's like you know, there's certain dishes that I create that are like that really remind me of those amazing things.
Well, this it's so interesting to me because this for me is sort of the intersection of cooking and writing, because I feel like at some point you just, and I think probably, I'm sure if I was a singer, I'd be like, and then I develop my own style, and this is how I, you know, how I use my voice. Like, there's this moment you come to, where a lot of people don't come to this moment, where you kind of, it all clicks, and you and your medium, there was this old Yeats poem, the dancer becomes the dance, right? Yes. Like when you and your medium become inseparable.
Yeah, I mean.
And you're lucky if that happens for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think this is only scratching the surface. It's like this, the euphoria that I felt when we got the review was, and the things that Pete was saying, Pete Wells, that is, like really kind of made me happy because, you know, I've left other jobs because they haven't like either like trusted me, or like my vision was like too weird, or just didn't make sense for a business, which I get. I mean, it's at the end of the day, this is a business, but I am like so happy because this is like literally, this is not like easy stuff, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I think the food is pretty easy, but it's like, this definitely like this speaks to like so many things of like what I am and what I like about food. Yeah. So like that, like, it's like the fact that people are liking it. I mean, like, I don't want to sound arrogant, but like this was a restaurant I was just like, I want to do stuff that I like that I like eating, like stuff that like I want to share with other people because I like it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I mean, like, it definitely is a kind of egotistical standpoint to say that, like, this is what I like, so you have to like it. But it's just like, this is what I like, try it, see if it works for you. And like, so far, I think it has for the most part. So like, that makes me happy. And that makes me like really excited about going to the next menu. I mean, like, the next season is like rapidly approaching.
But see, to me, the flip when you, I don't know, what word did you just use? Maybe it sounded, what did you say, arrogant or egotistical?
Yeah, I kind of.
But see, to me, though, I feel like if you're cooking in that way, I mean, you have to have the goods, right? You have to be able to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. So assuming that is a baseline, right? I feel like the more personal it is, the better it will be in this way that's very hard to even explain. You know, I Gavin Kazin, who is kind of the unsung hero to me of the Bocuse d'Or American effort. You know, Gavin was largely responsible for Thomas Keller and Daniel Boulud and all these guys getting involved in the thing. And I was around that competition. I wrote a book about it almost 10 years ago. And, you know, I was watching at the time Tim Hollingsworth, who was a sous chef at the French Laundry, and then subsequently other people coming up with the food they were going to cook in the competition. And it's a very fraught process. A lot of times, most of the people who compete in that competition are sous chefs. People who are chefs or chef owners can't take that time away. So you're watching someone who's not yet a fully formed chef creating something that's going to go on the world stage into competition. And I remember at one point I said to Gavin, why can't, you know, Thomas or Danielle or Grant Achatz or like, why can't some genius we have involved just design the freaking food and the guy we send into battle cooks it? And Gavin said, it won't be the same.
Yeah.
It won't be the same. There'll be something missing. At the time, I disagreed with him, but I've come to agree with that point of view. I understand it now. I've done, you know, probably a couple hundred more interviews since then with chefs. I get it. And I think, to your point, I don't think that sounds arrogant at all. To me, it sounds wise. No, to me, it's something that a chef needs to realize. And I think probably a lot of the times the food gets a little simpler when you come to that conclusion.
I mean, and Pete said that as well. And at first I was like, he said that like the food has calmed down since Le Turtle. And I don't know if that was true, but then like I started thinking about it and I was like, yeah, I guess it's just become more straightforward. And like, that's what takes, I mean, it's easy to like throw like 90 different techniques and a bunch of different ingredients, but like, it takes some real guts to like put like two or three ingredients and be like, yeah, that's it. Like,
yeah, or
it
even
is really good.
I remember the first time going to Momofuku Sambar and the ham.
Yeah,
the ham. It was just ham.
But it was a really good ham.
I mean, they had the red eye gravy, they called it. Yeah, but still.
But it was
that was breathtaking at the time.
It's sourcing good products. I mean, like a great chef. I mean, I think it was like Magnus was talking about it in like the chef's table that he's like when he was at Lestrance, Pasquale was like, you know, the ingredient's never going to be better than when it walks in the door. Like when you get that raw ingredient, if it's not that great ingredient, like, you can do whatever you want to it. It's going to be the best when it comes in that perfect. And like, that's something luckily that going back to my childhood, like, I mean, my grandmother and grandfather, they had gardens. So like we got
that's
to
that's classic New Jersey.
Yeah,
right?
I got to eat like fresh produce from their garden that they grew. And it's like, nothing's going to taste that good. Like, cause it's like you go, you pick it and it's like, yeah, like there's a big stigma about like that sense of like getting your own stuff, growing your own stuff. And like, someone else might try and be like, that's not very good. But like, you try and you're like, no, that's really good. Like that's the fruits of my labor.
Yeah.
Like really tastes great.
Yeah.
So yeah. I just been talking about my dad, but like my mom was a very big pusher of my creative force. I mean, she was always like, my dad was very like, do good in school. Like, play sports, like be good, do everything, be the best at everything.
Discipline driven.
Very, which is great because without him, I mean, I don't think I would have that drive that I currently have. But like that, and like there's that yin and yang, and like my mom was very creative, and she always was like, you know, and she was the person that I was confiding in a lot when I wanted to switch. I was like, Mom, I really want to do it. She's like, just do it. Like I want to get out of finance. She's like, just do it. I mean, my career in cooking I would be nothing without the help of a lot of really strong women. Like, it's insane.
That's so interesting. And a lot of guys I've talked to over the years, and I'm saying specifically guys, because it is what I'm about to say is specifically guys, because it's interesting. The dad, not so interested in them going the cooking route. They spoke to the mom.
Yeah.
And the mom, I've heard stories of moms surreptitiously paying for culinary school. it's amazing.
Without her push, I probably wouldn't have done it. I mean, I would have probably still been in an office right now, being very miserable, not very happy, staring at a computer. Wow. So I'm like very happy for that. And also, throughout the cooking career, I mean, I've had very supportive girlfriends who have been very instrumental in my career. I mean, just being there, being understanding. Some of them less than others, unfortunately, just because it's a tough industry. It's a tough industry.
Yeah.
I'm sure. I'm on this side, so I can't speak to the other side. But I mean, without those strong women, I mean, I would be nothing. And I'm saying that with complete honesty. It's just, I mean, I've had girlfriends just basically introduce me to so many other different cuisines, so many different ingredients and stuff. This is a pretty emotional job. You need emotional support, and to have someone that's there for you is like a big thing.
Have you mostly dated within the industry?
I've never dated within the industry.
Really?
Never. Once.
But you've had girlfriends who were able to kind of roll with the schedule and all that stuff.
Which I don't know how they did it.
No.
I mean, I barely can handle my schedule. I don't know how someone else could, but
it's tough.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is like, you know, without them, you know, without them, I would be nothing. Cause they could, if I was them, I'd be like this, I've never seen this person. They're coming home at like midnight, 1 a.m, generally either up before I am or just, or still sleeping when
gone.
I leave for work.
Or gone. Just
so,
gone.
So, I mean, without that, like I don't think I would be as happy as I am. Cause I mean, I just luckily have had those great moments. And those people that have been really strong and like really have shown me different things. I mean, one of my favorite dishes is our pork collar dish, and the last ingredient that we put on that dish that I think really creates like this crazy umami are Chinese fermented black beans, and that's from a ex-girlfriend's mom's recipe. It's legit her mom's recipe. She showed me exactly in Chinatown where to get this special it's called like this Chinese candy, the sugar that we use for it, and the specific brand of fermented black beans. Because the first time I tried hers at her house, I was like, oh my god, I was like, I need this in my life. Yeah. Like, this is so good. So, you know, like it's funny. It's like there's so many things. And like I try to think of this a lot, especially when I'm making my menu. It's like it's so hard. It's like when you're trying to put like so many things on a menu or so few things on a menu and you want to have all this inspiration. It's hard because there's, you know, I get it from everywhere. I mean, I'm kind of that guy. Like I, when I leave my house, I mean, I have headphones on, I'm listening to music all the time. And like, I'd hate to say I'm one of those people that just kind of are staring up and like causing like foot traffic in New York. But I mean, like I'm very, very tactile and very like observant of a lot of things. So like I get random ideas from anything, like from anything. And like, especially walking around the New York and like, just like seeing things and like, that's what this is about.
So it's you mean not just food, you mean you get ideas from
architecture,
music,
a lot.
Architecture a lot.
I mean, I took a lot of architecture classes in college and I just think it's like really cool. It's like it's the same way with like presenting food. It's like presenting a functional idea. I mean, theirs is definitely different than what we do. But like, you know, like I think that like, I think architecture is really cool. And I think when you're plating a dish, like thinking about that, like layering things and like how we layer flavors, how we design a guest to eat something is kind of important. And like, it's like, I don't want to be that guy. It's like, you have to eat this way. Like a big thing is that I try to make a dish where it's like, create your own adventure.
There's
ingredients. Like if you want to swipe it through this, you can do that. If you want to eat it by itself, you can do that.
Interactive.
Like at the same time, it's like, you know, we have a dish that has a broth. And if I see someone using a fork, I'm like, just use a spoon.
Right.
Like just use a spoon.
Or drink it out of the bowl or something.
Use a spoon. It's going to be better. And like,
get a straw.
I don't want to do that because if they're enjoying it, they're enjoying it.
Right.
But yeah. I mean like, you know, there's architecture is a big thing. Music. I don't know if music really influences my food, but it definitely is one of the main things that keeps me going. I mean, if you go down to the kitchen, there's music in the kitchen. from the moment I get there to the moment I leave. There's music in the dining room. Luckily, we have an open kitchen. And one thing I asked for when I came aboard is I was like, let's put speakers in the kitchen as well. So it's tied together. So there's always that vibe. I just like it. Music is a very big part of my life.
I always have something going in my ears.
Always.
Either a podcast or music. Yeah. I just recently made myself for at least maybe 30 minutes a day.
Not do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, I'm addicted.
It's a drug.
I was like, I'm addicted to sound. I'm addicted to stuff coming into my brain. And I actually realized I wasn't taking any time for just quiet.
Like reflection. Yeah,
yeah, it's or even writing with nothing in the background.
Oh, see, I was a person in the library or in my room that I had to have headphones on to study.
Yes.
I had to. I had to decide. It's like, it sounds like kind of morose, but I always had to have something distract me from like the current environment, which is not like because I'm not happy in it, but I just like having
that's the ADHD.
I like that sound. I like the soundtrack to your life. You know, I like having
that's
that music.
The ADHD.
I like having that music in my ears at all time, and like you know, and like the same thing with taste memory, music, like especially like old music, new music, like some old music, like it. I definitely relate it to specific moments, and like a funny thing that happened like literally like 2 days ago is we had like this like hair band station on, which I love so much.
Yeah.
And the song, I think it's REO Speedwagon, like Stroke Man came on.
Uh-huh.
And that's such a funny scene in Adam Sandler and Billy Madison where like he shows up to high school like 20 years later and he's trying to be all 80s and cool and it's like 2005.
Yeah.
And literally I connected eyes with Tyler, my sous chef, and we just started laughing because we both were like, I cannot think of that.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, like I like that because I'll be just walking down the street and out of nowhere a song will come on and there'll be like a flush of emotions of like really cool things that reminds me of, and then it sends my brain off on another tangent. Like say it's like it reminds me like of a girl I used to date. Then it's like, oh, it reminds me of like this food that we ate together that one time. And it's like, oh, why don't I do something like that? And it's like, it's
and then what happens? You have that moment. You just what? You order up some stuff.
I have to put it on my phone. I have to put it on my notes.
You write it down.
My Google Notes. And then you'll try to
render that in some culinary form.
Not necessarily. Yeah, I try to, but like not necessarily immediate. Like it's never like there's very few.
There's
moments.
Not an urgency.
Yeah, there's never very few moments where something happens. I'm like, oh, I got to do this, and it just, I don't know. It just. I usually
let it kind of percolate, marinate.
I let it marinate for a little while. That's a great word. I use that word a lot in everyday life. Uh-huh. It's a great, like letting thoughts marinate. It's like a very Greg thing that I say.
And then a moment arrives where you're like, I know what it is.
Or especially like if I'm home and like sitting down, relaxing, having like a cocktail. And then I look at my phone, I'm looking at my notes. Cause I mean, I have just books and books and books and sketchbooks and moleskins of ideas. And then I have to like go in and like look at it and actually be like, all right, let's make this real, or let's try to. And like literally 20 times it doesn't work, maybe you'll get one that works.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you ever dream of dishes? Do you ever wake up with an idea for a dish?
I don't dream. I mean, I know I do, but I never remember my dreams ever. It's
okay.
I don't know if that's like if that's a bad thing. I got
that might be a product of not sleeping enough.
I was gonna say maybe, but like I feel like it's so funny because like I don't really sleep, but like this opening this restaurant specifically just because of it has been very, you know, very long hours and very like very strenuous in all the right ways. But like I feel like I became narcoleptic. Like at any point I feel like if I put down my head I can fall asleep now. Like
I've been I gotta tell you something. I'm older than you, obviously. I've been like that my entire life and I'm still
never been like that. Like I can't fall asleep on cars. I can't fall asleep on planes. Like I can't fall asleep. I have to have like a perfect environment. And I always, it's funny playing back on what you said is I always had to have music or something going on when I was sleeping.
Yeah.
Always. And now I've transitioned into just nothing. Just
well my favorite thing now is you know, on your iPhone, you can set a podcast or whatever.
And a sleep timer.
Sleep timer. Yeah. That's the greatest.
Yeah. Now
and I'm pretty good at estimating how long it's going to take. So there are days where I'm so tired, I know I'm going to be like asleep
in 5 minutes.
And I so don't want the quiet. I will set the sleep timer for like the absolute minimum. And then there are times where I know it's going to take me a while to fall asleep, and I'll let the whole thing run.
Yeah. Now, I mean, now I think I'm like I could be the perfect sleeping partner because I can just like you're like, oh, you want music on? Fine. You want the windows open? Fine. Like it doesn't matter. Like if I'm gonna hit the bed, I'm gonna be out. Like that's I'm gonna funny. Be out. And then my problem is I'm a bad snoozer. I'm a real bad snoozer. I have like 5 alarms set, like all within like 4 minutes of yourself. Yeah. Cause I have a panicking fear of sleeping through my alarm.
You're not sleeping enough.
Well, that's the thing. Why. It's like, I just feel like I'm going to sleep through things. Well, and I hate being late for
when
anything.
When I was in college, so this is, I've never liked going to sleep. I think it's a death thing.
It's like what Nas said. It's the cousin of death. He's a smart man.
So like when I was in college, this is really dating myself, but this is before cell phones. So there was a thing in New York called 540 Wake. It was a service, but that's a phone number, right? It was 540 Wake. And you could call it and punch in a time, you know, using the touchtone phone.
And
it would call you. So A, I would do that. B, I had to have at least 2 alarms.
Yeah.
But C, you know, I would just did not go to sleep. And as a result, I would fall asleep at diners at 3 a.m. with friends. I would fall asleep in movie theaters. I would just everywhere, but also waking up was really hard for me. And if I had something really important, like an exam or something like that, I literally would put on my dorm room door on the outside, I would make a sign that said, if you are walking past this door and it is after X time, whatever I need, you know, please. And I would write in all caps, pound on this door. And I had total strangers would like,
Just
wake me up. I mean, it was like Good Samaritans. And then I worked in film production in my 20s. And at one point I was in LA for 3 months and I was working on an American Playhouse, this PBS thing. And I was part of the crew. And one of the things I had to do every day was charge all the walkie-talkies. Everyone had like 4 jobs, mm-hmm. you know, and I had to bring all the walkie-talkies. But call time every day was like 5:30.
Oh, God, yeah.
There were days where I overslept. I mean, even for that, like there was nothing important enough that I could not oversleep for it.
I could oversleep for anything in my life.
Yeah, if somebody was like, Scott Fitzgerald came back from the dead and you can have lunch with him tomorrow, just be there, I could oversleep for that. Like literally, there was nothing that I was incapable of oversleeping for.
Yeah, I mean like tonight I'll close the restaurant. Tomorrow, Tuesdays are my open days where I know it's kind of weird, but I mean I like to open every once in a while. I mean, sure. I'm working every day. It's like that's not the best thing, but it's like I like being in, you know, at 6 a.m. one day a week because it's like usually I do like a bunch of pasta projects. Like I do a lot of, it's like a day where it's like, you know, if you're in a kitchen from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., it's like the amount of stuff that you can take care of in one day is like incredible. So it's like, that's like the day that like gets like the whole week started for us. So like, and like tomorrow I will set 9 alarms because I'm deathly afraid that I'm not going to be here to open. And then I have panic nightmares. So like tonight I'll go to sleep. Like let's say I get to bed by midnight. I will wake up at 1:05. And check my phone and be like, all right, it's 1 o'clock, I'll go back to sleep.
Yeah, like
I'll
wake up
at 2:30.
Right, like if you had a flight in the morning.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's something, like I have that perpetual fear of not being somewhere when I should be.
My chest, I feel tightness in my chest just talking to you because this is my life too.
All right, good. So, good, at least you're in the same boat.
We got to wrap up in a couple of minutes here. But can you, first of all, you know, you've mentioned a few times putting off the cooking thing. How young were you when you knew you wanted to do it?
It was old. It was when I was probably 21, probably my senior year in college. I got done with my major early, so that essentially led to me not doing anything my senior year, except hanging out a lot. And I got into cooking a lot. Like I just like, cause I, we had a great, it was a very international school. So like our campus grocery store was really stocked with like really good stuff. Like,
so you started screwing around with
so
stuff?
I started really playing around. I started looking at cookbooks and like, I literally immediately when I graduated, I told my parents, I was like, I really want to go to like CIA. I want to continue my education in like a serious culinary school. And pretty much my dad was like, you should probably try out, you know, your business side because you just spent all these years you know, working really hard for it. And I was like, yeah, you know, I really want to. And then he, of course, was like, yeah, but you should probably try it out. And I was like, all right, well, it's really seems like, and he's like, you should try it out. I was like, all right, I'm going to try it out. So I did that. And the whole time, literally the entire time I was there, I was like, all right, I got to do this. I got to find a way out.
Well, also, not to put down that crap. I mean, I've had friends and roommates over the years. No. But also, the financial world, and I don't want to offend your dad, but no, there's a lot of people there. They're there to make money.
That's it.
There's a lot of people who lead fairly unexamined lives. They don't have a particularly artistic bent or even really an interest in that stuff. I mean, I'm not trying to be critical.
No,
but
it's
for a
job.
Guy like you, I imagine that was a very sort of dead place to be.
I just didn't, yeah, I didn't want the job to be a job. I wanted to be something I could like immerse myself in. And like, and maybe I could have, maybe if I had a better mind frame of it, and maybe if I better, you know, if I thought about it differently, I could have, but it just didn't seem like it was something for me. So like I, like my senior
year. Did you feel just, but beyond that, did you feel like out of place in that world?
No, I mean, I
like
never,
socially,
I never really feel out of place. I feel pretty comfortable. And like, if something's uncomfortable, I'm the guy that trying to tends to make awkward situations more awkward because I just
so you can adapt.
So I think it's just funny because it's I don't really get like shy or awkward around it, really anybody.
Yeah.
I'm just who I am. So I never felt out of place. Like, I mean, you know, I was playing sports in college. Like, I mean, I kind of fit the I guess the mold of like, you know, like the ex-athlete, like guy who wants to like make some money. And like it was like it was cool. Like there were some things I did that I really liked.
Yes.
But it was unfulfilling. That's in like, and like, it's no knock towards the, towards the industry, towards anyone that does it. I still have a lot of friends who do it a lot, and they're living very fun lives, going on vacation.
I'm sorry,
stuff.
Friends of Greg's.
Yes.
Did I offend all your friends just now?
No,
I feel bad.
No one's offended. They're good. they're enjoying their lives. So like, and like, and, you know, and like, and they went that route, and like, I definitely did not think that was ever gonna be something for me. Yeah. Like, and I kind of knew it. Like, the first minute I stepped in like the office, I was just kind of like, I was like, I gotta get out.
Yeah.
And then like, I did it for a year, and I tried another job. I did that for a year and a half, and like the last 6 months of my second job, I was just like, all right, I'm just gonna start saving because I'm gonna go into culinary school. I'm gonna save try to save a ton of money so I can literally just do nothing but while I'm in culinary school, just focus on food.
Yeah.
And then try to get into the best restaurant I can, and then see where that goes. I mean, it was a pretty big leap. I mean, it was pretty daring to, you know, to leaving an industry where, you know, you're pretty well compensated to one where I was a 26-year-old line cook making like $10.50 an hour, which is pretty insane. It was very, it was a big change. But I mean, like, you know, I always think about this, and I talk to people about this, like, you know, why'd you do it? Why didn't you do it earlier? And like, you know, it's like, 'cause I started cooking late. But you know, timing I think is everything. And like, I've been very lucky with the timing that I've had over the restaurants I've been at and everything. And so it's, you know, like maybe if I did start earlier, maybe who knows where I'd be right now? Like who knows where my career had it taken me? I mean, I think that I've made very smart decisions of when to leave or where to start places. I mean, because my, like some of my best jobs, you know, they were the most influential. I mean, EMP was the best place I could possibly start. I mean, it teaches you how to work. It teaches you how to work in a system that is just really, really organized and really works well. And then I went to Graffiti, and my chef Jesus Nunez really kind of brought the creativity out of me and let me play with stuff and let me like start finding my own voice. And then Blanca was just like, you know, Carlo really set my career in a completely different tangent. Mm-hmm. And like, I think every day when I'm cooking and when I'm preparing stuff, and I think about that because I mean that left a really big lasting like effect on me.
It's
like
amazing.
That place. Yeah.
So you've been lucky. You've had a couple of mentors.
Absolutely. I've had many. My first one was a guy, Chris Flint, who literally, you know, just beat the crap out of me every day. But he knew how to push me in a way to get the best out of me. And that was at EMP, and he was the one who was a big part of why I was hired there. And he really, really kind of set me on a path that I still do. And like the way I set up my station, the way I I have everything organized in my station, that still goes back to things that he taught me.
Well, you know, you mentioned athletics, right? And I think, and you just said he knew how to push you, right? And I've always felt that the coach analogy at this level is identical in that I think a good coach, like a good chef, knows that there's no one size fits all boss, right? You will get the best out of different people by understanding who they are and acting accordingly.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. I mean,
very similar. I mean, the guy who taught me tennis, took up tennis as an adult. There are still moments where on the court, it's like Obi-Wan in the first Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like I hear his voice in my head. And I hear it. Don't go for the feeling.
Yeah.
Because he knew that was a weakness of mine.
That's,
you know,
it's
crazy.
That's one of the hardest things, I think, when you become a sous chef. I know it in my first one is like how to push people. Because like, yeah, you can yell at everybody, but like what's that about? Like, I mean, that's not going to get you anywhere.
No.
But like choice, like raising your voice in choice times is like very important, I think. Like knowing when you have to be stern, knowing when, and we're not a yelling kitchen. Like, I do not yell. Mm-hmm. I just don't like it. I just don't like it because it gets me really fired up, and it's like I don't like that. I try to stay very zen throughout all service. And like I said, we have music. Everything is like, and you see, like we'll do a really busy night, but everything's like very just calm, like very.
So you can communicate an urgency if you need to.
I can
in tone of voice
and like tone of voice or just
or
like,
even a look.
Yeah, I mean, looks. I have a pretty. Pretty good stare. I think they get it. And like a lot of my, some of my friends or guests, they have like, you know, RBF, like they're like resting bitch face. And I really feel bad that I have that because when I think my brow furrows a lot and like I'm constantly thinking, especially when I'm like working with food, like I'm always thinking of like a different way to do this.
Yeah.
So like sometimes it comes across as like, just like, I think one guest asked one of our servers, like, oh, is he mean, like, in, like, Hell's Kitchen? And they're like, no. They're like, oh, he kind of looks at me, and I was like, they're like, he is not at all. Like,
I mean, can I be honest? The first time I spoke to you, I was surprised, because you have intense eyes.
Very intense eyes, yes.
You've got the beard. You've got a look.
Yes.
I mean, we have a mutual friend, Mike Gibney.
Of course.
Who I love. Who's also
sweetheart.
Probably a better writer than I will ever be. And I mean that, Michael. So I knew you had to be a nice guy because you're buddies with him.
Yes.
But when I first spoke to you, I was like, God, he's so nice. You know, yeah, I was it's terrible to judge
I'm gonna have
a preconception.
I'm going to shave the beard off soon. So that's
really?
Gonna be, yeah, I mean, I do it every once in a while. I don't know. I just get bored with it. I constantly need to be in flux.
But when people said that question, I do understand that because it was for me, but this speaks to a weakness in me. This has nothing to do with you.
It's fine because like a lot of times, like especially like across the counter from me, like one of the guests will like whisper like something like asking about an ingredient or something. And like maybe because they don't want to like bother me or talk to me. Yeah. And then I'll just like go over there and I'll have like a 5-minute conversation with them about like that will range from everything. Like it will just go off on tangent. So like, yeah, I mean like I have to tell my cooks that I'm like, you know, I'm like, don't think I'm not approachable. Like I'm the most approachable person in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
talk to me about anything. And I will always talk to people.
Yeah.
Like I love talking to people.
That's how you, I mean, I could keep this interview going.
That's the way I've always thought learning is like, you have to get respect from people, especially like your own cooks. Like you have to listen. You have to like be willing to understand what's going on with them and like what their standpoint is because you know there's a million different ways to do things. So like, you know, just being open to like listening to people is just like it's what I want to do.
One last thing. You were talking about communication with your team a minute ago. And I said, you know, you could put a little urgency in your voice and you said sometimes just a look. I've always thought a real good analogy, and I would just love your two cents on this, is a band. If you watch a band,
whenever they make
eye contact, you can see sometimes there's like there's a song that gets added, or they're going to do a segue, or they're jamming, and now that we're going to end it, and that's all communicated without words, right?
Yeah.
It's all communicated through people knowing each other so well and being in the trenches so much that they know what an eyebrow means.
Yeah.
They know, right?
Tyler.
Do you experience it that way?
Tyler, my Tyler Hackman, my number two. He knows my eyebrows.
He knows what you're thinking. You know,
like if something comes up and I'll look at it and I'll look at him, like I'll give him a look and I'll be like, hey, I'll take care of it. Like he knows exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's also why I think like that this opening is went like really, really nicely is because we are on the same wavelength. I mean, and that's important. Like, and like,
how many people on your opening crew had worked with you before?
Four
out of how many?
Out of six, seven.
Yeah.
So like a pretty good amount.
Yeah.
And like, I was so happy about that. Like Tyler, I met pretty late. He came into La Turtle towards the end of my tenure, and he was just so happy with the way we work together and like kind of the wavelength that we're on with food and what we like about it and the flavors we like and kind of the weirdness of it that we really like. And that's why he jumped aboard and like I talked to him and like I couldn't be any happier having him be here with me because like we the things that we've created together have been amazing. And my other Sue, Nathan is, he was our first hire at Le Turtle.
Yeah.
So that was a big one because that was a really difficult place to open, a really difficult place to work. It just was very tough.
Yeah.
And he came from kind of an interesting cooking background. He was just at Terst, you know, the place that was, you know, with Luxus. And, he was coming from there and like had like a, had like a pretty good time, but like, you know, never really got to like, kind of be his personality. He has a great personality. And like one of the best things about working in a kitchen is that there's so much personality in him that I love him. Like it's never just stale. It's always just so weird for the best word. It's just the weirdest place in the world. Because you have these people from all walks of life, all orientations that just come together to do something great, which is a great thing about it. But, Nate, I met, that was the open, he was my first hire at Le Turtle, first hire as an executive chef. And then he's gone away, has come back, gone away, come back.
Yeah.
And now he's with us. And I mean, I think he's going to be a really integral part. He's had 4 weeks off. He had this vacation plan for about a year and it literally synced up to where the Wednesday that the New York Times review came out was the first day that he was going away. So he's been gone for like 3.5 weeks. So like, he's going to come back into a whirlwind, which I'm excited about. And then, my opening Sue, like the guy who's doing our opening is this guy, Joseph, who I met through Michael Gibney, actually back, geez, maybe 2014, 2013. Yeah. So I've known him for a while. And then the rest are just, new friends. And I mean, I have a guy, like I said, I have a guy, this guy Sang, who's from North Carolina, who came here to work and got connected through an old CDC at a restaurant, now works as a purveyor for one of our great purveyors, Regalis. And like, he came because he was speaking highly of our restaurant. Yeah. Like, it's just like, it's such a funny world. Then I have a guy who I think found us through Instagram. He worked at DOM in Brazil. Uh-huh. Like,
wow.
Like, and then I have an amazing girl, this girl Sohini, who went to like culinary school in India and is working with us and is like, you know, it's just like we have such an interesting group of people that all just are so strong. And it's like, you know, like I,
and it all gels.
And I couldn't be, be happier. Like we have the dream team. We have when us five, because I mean, we only work with five people and this is a tiny kitchen servicing the whole hotel and a really busy dinner service. A 38-seat restaurant doing three turns is like a lot. It's just like we have these five people and it's like the best part about it is like when I know these five people are here and like, you know, we're looking for that sixth link, that like sixth person just to like come in and just help us crush stuff, is it's like I don't have to worry. Like, there's no worries about the food. Yeah. Like, that's like really nice. Like, there's gonna be hiccups in service. There's gonna be a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And like, you know, and it's like they're all doing it because they want to do the right thing, because they feel this energy. They feel like how fun it is and how cool it is. And like what we're doing is like something special. And like, that's like, that to me is like, you know, like it's almost like we don't have to communicate.
Right.
We just don't. Like we just are able to just to do the right thing. And like when I'm asking for something, if this is already being done, like it's already being done.
Yeah.
You know, and like a lot of that is because me and Tyler specifically, we've trained these guys very well. And it's just, they're just, you know, I hate to use that phrase, but like they're drinking the Kool-Aid. Like they know what we want to do and they want to do it and they're doing really well and it's fun. And like, they're smiling. Like I've never seen so many smiles in a kitchen. Like, and like, usually it's like a very like, you know, aggressive place. And like, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, like I've been in some of those kitchens and they're fun and like, they're really tough. And like, you know, it's like a marathon. It's a full body workout. But like here, we're just kind of doing our thing, having fun. And it's like,
that's awesome.
It's something I've never experienced. We're not doing anything that out of the ordinary. I think a lot of places are doing that now, like where they're really taking care of like the cooks. And like, I think that's really important.
It's definitely a moment of evolution.
Yes. And like, I'm really excited about seeing where it goes because, I think it's like everything that's happening for the most part is being done properly. So, I mean, it's making it a really fun, great place to work. And
awesome.
What more can you ask for? I mean, I've been in terrible jobs with good people and that makes it better.
Yeah.
I've been in good jobs with terrible people that have made it better. Like that have made it worse.
Yeah.
And this is just a good job with good people. Like it's just good. It's fun.
It's great. I'm happy for you.
Thanks, man. I'm
congrats on everything.
I'm
I know you're not happy. Spiking the football, but, Keep it going.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait to see what this year brings. It's gonna be a fun one. I know that.
Thanks for making the time.
All right, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And that's our show. I want to give a huge thank you. Actually, Caitlin, you're still here.
I know.
So I'm thanking you, as always.
You're welcome.
And you wanted to stay here because at the book party I referred to at the top of the show, you and David Tedeschor, the engineer,
yes,
who I allude to you guys back and forth, you two had never even spoken, texted, emailed with each other.
I find him to be a saint because he listens to us and he actually says that he likes it.
He came to this very crowded party. It was chock-a-block, as they say, with well-known legendary chefs. And first thing he says to me is, not, will you introduce me to, you know, Druni Porrent or Alfred Portale or David Burke or Tom Colicchio? He says, where's Caitlin?
Oh, see, I love you, David.
So, David, thank you, as always. I am going to quickly let people know I will be speaking Monday the 12th, this coming Monday, at the Philadelphia Chefs Conference at Drexel University. If you're in Philadelphia, you can look it up. PhillyChefConference.com, I think, maybe .org. Sorry, I should have checked that, but easily found online. Lots of great speakers. And next week, Thursday, March 15th, in New York City at the 92nd Street Y, which is one of those dream venues for any writer, 92nd Street Y, Jeff Gordner, the food and drinks editor of Esquire, will be interviewing me about my book. Thursday, March 15th, it's in the evening. 92nd Street Y's website is easily found, and there's still tickets available. I would love to see you guys there. And I do have to also say, I met a chef last week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Did I tell you about this?
No.
I was at the Santa Monica Farmers Market about to do an interview for this very show, and a guy comes up to me and says, are you Andrew? And I said, or he says, is your name Andrew? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I listen to your podcast.
No way.
Yeah. It was the chef of Superba restaurant in Venice. I got spotted. I got recognized off the podcast. So, Anthony, thank you for saying hello to me. If you listened to the very end of the show, thank you. That was really cool. Yeah, it was awesome. I always tell people, if you see me, say hello. Anthony could vouch for me. I was glad he said hello. And then he came and saw the talk I did with Ruth Reichel at Live Talks LA. It was amazing.
I love that story.
It made the city feel very small to me. It always feels welcoming, but it made it feel extra welcoming to be in Los Angeles. Anyway, do I have anything else to tell people?
I think that might be it.
Okay, if you feel like subscribing to the show on Stitcher or iTunes, please do that. And in the meantime, that's it. I'll see you all back here next week, if not sooner, as we do have some extra episodes queued up. As soon as I can get them edited and introed and find me and Caitlin at a time that we're both awake, we'll get those up on the air for you guys. But at the very worst, you'll see us back in a week on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Thanks for listening.